The world now stands at a record 8 billion people. That is 8 billion people requiring food, natural resources, and energy. However, the population boom is not coming from the most affluent countries. Rather, it is those regions already struggling for adequate provisions driving the growth. On this edition of 360 View, we are going to look at what this could mean for the geopolitical landscape in the future. Let's get started. Thank you for joining us. You know, every day, 227,000 people on average are added to this planet. And as the population continues to grow, so does the demand for food, natural resources, and energy. But while some might worry civilization is on the brink of overcrowding and starvation, the world today looks nothing like the population apocalypse doomsdayers have been warning about for decades. Now, this doesn't mean there isn't challenges which will need to be addressed. Ultimately, will the more developed countries, whose trend is to be below the replacement level, be responsible for those countries who continue to produce a surplus of babies? And does just the number of citizens in a country grant it more power, or does it matter the quality of life of the population? Now, one of the most important trends in understanding global development is called a demographic transition. Now, this is where wealthy societies tend to give women more opportunities outside the home, thus making the average family size smaller. Now, most, in fact, are below the replacement level, which means a set of parents has fewer than two children. This causes the population to shrink over time. Now, this is true in countries like Japan, South Korea, the EU, and the United States. Africa, however, seems to be going in the opposite direction. The sub-Saharan region has the world's highest average fertility rate at 4.6, with Niger topping the list at 6.8 children per woman, followed by Somalia at 6, Congo, Mali, and Chad, each having fertility rates of over 5. In fact, according to UN projections, the number of Africans will double by 2050 and make up a quarter of the world's population. Now, the availability of family planning, including access to contraception and abortion, as well as government population planning initiatives, also can help keep a certain population limited. But even with all of these in place, the global population will continue to grow, hence why planning and development is necessary, all in order to prepare for a growing population. To discuss the population boom, we are now joined by John Wilmuth, who is the UN Director of Population Division. Thank you so much for joining me, John, on this.
Happy to be here.
So what are the main population concerns that the UN is grappling with at the moment?
Well, concerns, we track the growth and the change of the global population. I think you expressed it well, that it's the view of this is a doomsday scenario because of human overpopulation is perhaps has been exaggerated, and we focus more as much on the opportunities of a larger population as we do on the challenges. So we track very closely what's going on. I think an important point to keep in mind, just to reflect on what you were just pointing out, it's true that most of the growth currently is happening in countries of the global south, in particular in sub-Saharan Africa. And that will continue over the next few decades. But they are going through a process of demographic transition that's very similar to what has happened in other parts of the world. The growth rates are going to continue slowing down worldwide. And that's also true in Africa. We expect that the fertility rate will continue to come down in those African countries that you mentioned. They may be at 5 or 6 births per woman now. They used to be at 7 or 8. You know, so the numbers have been coming down. And we expect that that will continue and that the growth will continue to slow down globally and in different parts of the world.
Okay, so then I'm going to ask you to put on your predicting hat. I'm sure you look at statistics and numbers all day long. What do you expect the world population to basically look like? Let's even go short term by 2050, which will still be in hopefully my lifetime. But 2100 itself, what are we expecting the world to look different? And will it be different from what we're seeing now?
Well, it'll be a larger world and it will be an older world. I mean, this is the key thing to keep in mind, is that this process of demographic transition towards longer lives and smaller families, it brings two major changes. One is growth, because the death rate tends to fall before the birth rate. You know, societies figure out how to keep people living longer, saving children from premature death and so forth. And that's what causes the growth, is the decline of the death rate. Eventually, then societies figure out, well, we don't need to have as many children in that situation in order to keep, you know, just to replace the generation to generation. And so the birth rate comes down as well. And in that, so, but in between those two changes, there's a period of growth. And so for the European countries and North America, the richer countries of the world, this happened, 100 years ago that we were in this period of growth, really coming to an end of that period of rapid growth. For Asia and Latin America, it happened much during the latter half of the 20th century. For Africa, it's still going on and will continue through the next few decades. So there's a period of growth. And then at the end of the demographic transition, there's a much older population because people live longer and we have fewer births relative to the rest of the numbers of population. And so therefore, there are more and more people at older ages and fewer at younger ages. So the planning that needs to take place is to anticipate the further increase in the size of the human population, but also to anticipate that we will continue to have an older and older population in all countries of the world. This is not just limited to the wealthier countries. This same transition is taking place in poorer countries as well as they develop economically and socially. It's all part of that process of economic and social development.
Well, it's interesting you bring that up because you're right. We talk about age, but I do want to look at these concerns. And are you finding, are you a little bit more concerned about the populations of developed countries and the more developed world versus those that are less? Are you seeing any difference or is it the same standards being applied or you're seeing trends in both countries?
Well, we're seeing very similar trends in the sense that, you know, throughout the world, there's been the increase of human life expectancy. That's, you know, the technologies that have made that possible and the economic changes that have made that possible, you know, the increase of the food supply, the better nutrition, that's really a global phenomenon. That has had the same impact worldwide in terms of raising life expectancy. But some countries are much farther ahead in that process and some are much farther behind. Likewise, all of the incentives around having children, you know, populations where education is highly valued and where women have opportunities outside the home, those are populations that have smaller families. As you mentioned, in that situation, people do not have the same incentives to have large families. And as long as they have access to the means of controlling fertility, they tend to lower the number of births over a lifetime, and that continues the change of this demographic transition that we're talking about. So are we more concerned about this situation in the developing countries or in the more developed world? I would say it's a different set of concerns. The rapid growth continues. The places where rapid growth continues today are mostly the poorest countries of the world, those that have multiple challenges to their economic and social development. And we believe that the rapid growth that's occurring there is an additional challenge that makes it even more difficult to kind of escape poverty and escape in some of the difficult situations that those countries are in. So, you know, for example, if you're trying to improve the education of all of your children, you'd like to focus on the quality, improving the quality of the education that's given to each individual child. But if you constantly have to deal with having 2 or 3% growth in the number of school children every year, then, you know, that there's a trade-off between these two things, expanding the coverage of the education system and expanding the number of students that can be accommodated and who can be educated, and then the quality of the education that each child receives. So society, we've seen that when societies lower their fertility, when smaller families are the norm, become the norm, there's more money and time available to invest in the younger generation and improving the quality of their education, the quality of their health care, and their ability then to contribute as adults to the society. So that's one set of concerns with, you know, rapid growth in poorer countries. But then there's another concern about rapid growth globally in terms of the impact that it's having on the global environment, the release of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, the effects that that's having on the climate. And that becomes really a global issue. And you shouldn't just look at population growth at that point. You also have to look at the growth of consumption. It's in the long term, really, it's the growth of consumption that drives the increased emissions of greenhouse gases more than the increase of the human population. The population contributes as well, but it's really more the increase in wealth, increase in income per person that has driven these changing global environmental trends are driven more by that than by the increase of the human population.
the break, we are going to discuss what the future looks like according to current population models.
Потребление наркотиков в Южной Америке в целом, в Бразилии в частности, на очень высоком уровне.
Кокаина. Só que aqui, olha, uma sacola dessa custa R$30.
E vindo ter, principalmente o norte, ele é muito falado, não.
Мы не знаем, что на этой реке происходит. Контроля здесь вообще практически никакого нет.
Eles conseguiram pegar quase uma tonelada aqui. Foi pego 420 quilos, depois foi pego mais 300 e poucos quilos pela polícia militar.
Hein, Karim?
Por aqui alguém morreu recentemente?
Já muita gente.
Ei, quem é você? Saia daqui! Eu tenho um facão.
Beleza! Plantando ali no meio do mato. Então essa área todinha era comandada pelos traficantes, entendeu?
Tá? Já quieta!
Каждый день убивают и много. Там просто дикий запад. По мне, Амазонка, да, это кокаиновая река. Большинство поставок идет через Амазонку.
Só a venda, porque a procura. Se não tivesse procura, não ia ter venda.
Eu sustento três filhos, né? Duas meninas, um menino e mais uma esposa. Cinco no caso.
Frank, I'm originally from Philadelphia. Got in the movement in 88. I was 13 going on 14.
We were violent towards those people because we believed that we were the superior race. We were here first, and this is our country.
Being part of that movement, I got to feel a sense of power when I felt powerless. I got attention when I felt invisible and accepted when I felt unlovable.
So Life After Hate is an organization that was founded by four ex-skinhead, neo-Nazi, white supremacists in the US and Canada. And they found each other, and they knew that they wanted to help other guys get out.
There's two parts to getting out of a violent extremist group. The first part is disengagement, which is where you leave the social group. And then the next part is de-radicalization, where the belief systems and the ideology are removed.
It was very impactful when someone finally came along with no fear, no judgment. He heard my story, did nothing to challenge it, but validated it.
Welcome back. We are rejoined by John Wilmoth, who is the UN Director, Population Division. What do you say to those who believe advocating for abortion birth control are immoral and cynical methods of dealing with overpopulation when those factor into the equation?
Well, abortion is a method of birth control. It's not considered a method of contraception. I mean, it does control the arrival of births, but I think we have to distinguish between contraceptives and abortion, because I think the moral issues that are involved are somewhat different for different people. So at the UN, we talk about ensuring that people have access to modern contraceptives and safe abortion where it is legal. So I don't really want to get into that issue. That's a choice. It's made by different countries based on their historical context and so forth. Where abortion is legal, we want people to have access to safe abortions. Throughout the world, we think people should have access to the modern contraceptives, which make it possible to control, these biological processes that people often want to have control over.
Absolutely. I can understand. And obviously, and you're darting through a very tricky situation as different countries. Obviously, religion plays a bigger role in some countries than other. But moving on, many can believe that we can support a much higher level of population than we currently have globally if resources were more distributed fairly. Do you agree with this? Do you think that the world as a whole should help cover those that might not be able to, that are limited in their resources?
Well, I think there's no doubt that the world can support a larger population. It is possible to grow more food. It is possible to find further, you know, additional energy sources. It's not, you know, people have often talked about the limits to growth as though it was just impossible for the human population to reach a certain size. And every time somebody put forward such a limit and said, well, we cannot go above such a limit, the global population then exceeded that some years later. You know, it's not clear that there's a limit in terms of the number of people who could be alive on this earth at any one point in time. The challenge comes not so much from the inputs to our consumption. In other words, you know, the ability to grow food, the ability to kind of find energy sources that will support that growth, all of that is possible, but it seems that the more serious issues relate to the after effects of human consumption. That's to say the pollution that we produce, including in particular the greenhouse gases that are emitted into the atmosphere and which are driving climate change with really very important consequences that I think all of us should be concerned about.
What effect did the global pandemic have on your projections and on your numbers there at the UN? Do you kind of already factor in something like that happening at time? Or was this something that made you all have to adjust your predictions and where your numbers were moving forward across, since this wasn't just something that hit one country, almost every country was affected?
Well, we can't minimize the significance of the pandemic. It's the first time that global life expectancy has declined for over 50 years. The pandemic was really, really very significant in that. We estimate that the life expectancy at birth globally fell by 1.8 years between 2019 and 2021. And that's really quite significant. Nothing like that has happened in over 50 years. On the other hand, if you think of it in terms of the long-term population trends that we're looking at, the world has been growing by around 80 million people per year, roughly. I mean, above and below that number, for the last 50 years, roughly, it's been kind of almost constant at that level, adding around 80 million people per year. The WHO's estimates of the number of people who have died, the excess mortality associated with COVID-19, are roughly on the order of 15 million in 2020 and 2021. So, you know, it's not a scale that, even though that's a huge number of deaths, there's no reason to minimize that, but it's not something that really affects the long-term trends of the human population. It's a blip in the long-term population trends for the world. It's probably not, it doesn't fundamentally change what we expect for the future decades. It did have an impact in those 2 years that was quite significant and continues to have an impact in some parts of the world. But it doesn't fundamentally change our understanding or our expectations for the global population trends over the next few decades.
Well, let's talk about those global population trends. Do you think we're in peril, let's say, if in the next 100 years, this global population doubles? And is there an optimal population to have now and in the future?
So the human population has doubled roughly in the last 50 years. You know, we reached 8 billion last month. We reached 4 billion in 1974, so that's almost five decades, right? Over that time period, we added an additional billion people every 12 years on average. As we move forward, we don't think that will happen again. We don't think the human population will double in size again. We don't think we'll ever get to anything like 16 billion people. We expect that the next billion, going from 8 to 9, will take a little bit longer, more like 15 years, because the growth rate is coming down. The growth is slowing down, as I mentioned earlier. Growth is slowing down. The next billion will take at least 15 years to add. The next billion, we project more than two decades it will take. And then beyond that, we don't think the global population will reach 11 billion, or it make it close to 11 billion, but it probably won't go much beyond that. So we don't expect another doubling of the human population. You know, to the extent that human population growth is a major problem, it's a problem that's in the process of being solved, in the sense that birth rates are coming down, the fertility rate is coming down all over the world, growth is slowing down. We've seen the growth rate back in the 1960s was just over 2% per year for the world as a whole. In 2020, the growth rate fell below 1% for the first time in that time, you know, since the 1950s, really. It fell below 1% for the first time since then. So, and it's continuing to go down, and we expect that will continue, and that by the 2080s, sometime in that decade, the growth rate globally may reach zero and may even go negative, so that the global population starts to decrease somewhat. So, you know, this is a process that's it's fairly well mapped out in terms of how it works. This demographic transition is something that's fairly well understood, and we've seen it happening in so many different populations. In fact, we see it happening all across the world. And so, you know, we can be fairly confident that the growth of the human population is slowing down and will come to an end probably before the end of this century.
You know, but it's interesting you say that because it's all based on basically people having children. It reminds me of kind of like when you have water going down sand, is it if you go on and create the divots it's going to go into, the water goes with it. Is that what we're, is that kind of what we're doing as a world? And as you're looking at your numbers, are we creating the path of it decreasing? Or is this just water is going to get to another source of water as best it can? It's just naturally happening. And basically you just kind of have to be along for the ride. Can we actually compel civilizations to have children or disincentivize them?
You know, it's possible to influence those things to some degree, although the governments that have tried to do that have often found it challenging. People don't necessarily go along with what the government wants them to do. Big surprise, right? But for example, you know, some countries that have very high levels of fertility have tried to encourage people to have smaller families, and they've had various information, educational campaigns, and they provide access to contraceptives. Some of them have engaged in coercive measures to discourage births, and those have some impact, at least for a period of time. But you know, it's not easy for governments to influence how many babies people have. At the other extreme, there have been governments that have been concerned that the birth rate was too low, and they wanted to raise the fertility rate. They wanted to encourage people to have more children, and they create various incentives. They provide bonuses for people at the time of the birth of a baby. They provide, you know, subsidized childcare. They provide, you know, paternal and maternal leave obligations for employers, and all of these can have some impact. But it's not a silver bullet. It doesn't just automatically solve the problem. And the things that matter most in those situations seem to be the ones that are more long-term, you know, not just a bonus, you know, not just $1,000 because you've had a third child, but rather, you know, a government-subsidized program of childcare to really make it possible for people to blend work and family and to balance those two things in their lives. That's really the issue, I think, that we're facing. We're now in a situation where two-thirds of the world's population lives in a country or area where the number of births per woman over her lifetime has fallen below 2.1 births over the lifetime of a woman. That's what we call the replacement level. That's the level at which each generation replaces itself with children. It's two children to replace the mother and the father, and another additional amount, mostly related to, you know, mortality among children and women before they finish their reproductive lifespan. So, but two-thirds of the world's population is now below that threshold of 2.1 births per woman. And so really that's the situation that we're in for most of the world's population. And the question becomes, do governments want to incentivize people to have more children? And I'm saying there are ways to do that. There are ways to encourage it, but it all really comes back to how do you make life, how do you make a balanced life that involves work and family, bringing children into the world, but also having a life outside the home, not only for men, but also for women, obviously, and making that possible and creating systems that really kind of allow people to live the life that they want to live and to have the number of children. We find when we do surveys in populations that have very low levels of fertility, we find that people want to have more babies than they're having. And, you know, how do we facilitate that? How do we make that possible? That's important.
Thank you to John Wilmoth, who is the UN Director, Population Division. The idea of population growth is potentially exponential, while the growth of food supply or other resources is linear, which eventually reduces the standard to the point of triggering a population die-off. That's all called Malthusianism. Now, the event could be a natural disaster, a famine, war, or even a sickness. Regardless, it would have to be catastrophic and affect more than just one country's population. Now, this is a theory created in 1778, but through the years has been held onto by many of the globalist elite and often discussed at global forums, like the annual World Economic Forum in Davos. I find it interesting that it is mainly those of the top tier of society and government who believe in controlling the population and this idea that we can overpopulate the world. The use of fear to motivate change should always be a red flag, especially if you are someone who believes in personal responsibility and freedom. Rarely do we see these people voluntarily rationing their own or sacrificing their luxuries. Rather, it is you and I who are supposed to consume fewer resources. Now, at the same time, countries, whether by choice or by government, which imposed rules to moderate their growth, having to be responsible for those countries who don't always seem, doesn't seem fair. Now, this would almost create a global welfare state, which would be impossible to have accountability with, and an endless drain on all resources. It would make the responsible work hard to cover those with less diligence. This would only create animosity and widen the gap between the provider and the provided. Population growth isn't about the general population of everyday workers. Rather, it's about those who hold the power over the population itself. The larger the population, the harder for a smaller elite group to be able to control. Now, the Earth's surface covers 196.9 million miles, and scientists can only guess how many living beings the Earth can hold. It's just an estimate, a guess. The constraints of the Earth are not fixed as she continues to develop and adapt in ways scientists were unable to predict in the past and definitely can't do it now. So scientists, politicians, and the people might have all of these theories on what the future might hold. But one thing, which is non-debatable, is it's definitely not a small world after all. I'm Skynell Hughes, and this has been your 360 view of the news affecting you. Thanks for watching.